I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The man that police now think killed 6-year-old Aiden Pates back in 1979 has reportedly been placed on a suicide watch. Pedro Hernandez is expected to be arraigned this afternoon on second-degree murder charges on this, the anniversary of Aiden Pates' disappearance 33 years ago today, after he was allowed to walk to the bus stop for the first time by himself. In fact, this is National Missing Children's Day, named in Aiden's honor by President Reagan. The suspect, Pedro Hernandez, was a teenage stock boy in a bodega in Aiden's neighborhood who'd reportedly told family members years ago that he'd killed a child. But it wasn't until police very publicly reopened this case, digging up a basement in Pates' old neighborhood last month, that a relative tipped off police. Police now say Hernandez has confessed to luring Aiden Pates into the store, strangling him, and putting his body out with the trash. Dean Memminger is a criminal justice reporter for New York One News, that city's 24-hour news channel. Dean, quite something. Why do police think Hernandez is different from others who've claimed to be involved in this case?
Well, one of the issues is that he had spoken to family members and church members over the years, confessing to them that he had killed a child in New York City, that he had did something horrible. So he did tell other family members this, according to the police department, and may have told a family member that he did something bad back as far as 1981.
Right, just a couple years after. Well, your station spoke with someone who remembered Hernandez from that neighborhood in 1979. Let's listen.
He was not there, if you know what I mean. There was something about him you could not be friends with him.
But the New York Times is reporting that people in his neighborhood now in New Jersey know Pedro Hernandez as a Pentecostal. They can't believe this about him. What more do we know about him?
Well, let me bring you up to speed because this is continuing to develop. We know there is a scheduled arraignment later this afternoon, but right now he is at Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan. That's a city-run hospital, but it has a huge psychiatric ward. So he is receiving some sort of psychiatric evaluation just hours before his arraignment.
Right.
He was taken there. So well, that could be an issue for the prosecution here, where he has to be evaluated before, perhaps even on some sort of suicide watch, as some media outlets are reporting.
Right.
So
well,
the situation with him currently.
But there are other questions as well. His name was not on a list of suspects back in 79, but it was in a detective's report as someone who worked in that bodega, so there are questions as to why he wasn't interviewed then. And then there's Jorge Ramos. Now, this is the friend of a woman who was hired to walk Aiden Pates home from school. He served prison time in Pennsylvania. In 2004, a judge found Ramos liable for Aiden Pates' death. That led to a civil suit, although he's never confessed. Now, we're going to hear more about Ramos in a moment. But we, of course, were wondering if perhaps Jorge Ramos and this new suspect, Pedro Hernandez, were in any way connected. And the Daily News is quoting a former detective in this case who's wondering that as well. Are you hearing about any possible connection?
Well, I was in a press conference with the police commissioner last night. He said at this point the investigation continues and that they don't know if there is a connection, but they're trying to speak to or re-interview as many people as possible, even trying to find out from old store workers at that bodega on the corner of West Broadway and Prince Street if they remember anything weird about the day Eitan went missing. So they are continuing to investigate. And right now, as we speak, the crime scene unit for New York City Police, they arrived to that location where the bodega used to be. It is now an eyeglass store. But police are back on the scene, perhaps trying to get into that store and perhaps trying to go into the basement to look for any sort of evidence. As you mentioned earlier, a month ago, the NYPD and FBI, they dug up another basement in the area looking for evidence, and all of the media hype over that dig led to a tipster calling into police about Pedro Hernandez.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, New York City Police Commissioner Kelly says that Pedro Hernandez, in his talks with police, has said specific things about the case. We'll, of course, hear more about this as reporting goes on today. Dean Memminger, a criminal justice reporter for New York One News there in New York City. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Lisa Cohen now. She's been covering this story for 22 years, starting as a fledgling producer at ABC News in 1990. Her 2009 book is entitled After Eitan, The Missing Child Case That Held America Captive. And she joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. Lisa, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are after being so steeped in this case for decades. And I imagine, you know, first of all, you're thinking about the parents.
Well, I am, and I'm also thinking about sort of the whiplash effect of this news, because I know how I'm feeling about it, which is this comes seemingly out of nowhere, and I know that this isn't something that they've had any time to digest at all.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what you learned about the life they lived after Eitan left. You know, we've been hearing never changed their phone number, but also kept detailed notes.
When the case first occurred, the New York Police Department told them that they had to write down every phone call that came in, number and contents. And so they started doing that, and it became a habit, and they do it today. So 33 years of notebooks filled with every incoming call and every way in which this could possibly be something to follow up on.
And they got wacky calls. I mean, this must have just ripped open the wound every time the phone rang.
Oh, I mean, when I started to write the book, there was a woman in Florida who was writing to Stan Pates, Eitan's father, to say that she was in the midst of a divorce from somebody and he had no photos of himself before the age of 6, and she wanted him to send a hairbrush with his hair so that they could have a DNA tested because she was convinced that she had been married to Eitan Pates. I mean, people would call from drunken parties to say, we're coming over to search the place. We know he's there. People would call and pretend to be Eitan. People would call in and confess, you know, or show up at their house to confess. I mean, this is one of hundreds of jarring and painful moments in this case.
Well, meanwhile, I'm sure you're also thinking of the detectives and the other suspects. Let's remind people who Jose Ramos was. In 1982, he was accused of trying to lure children. Police found pictures of young boys in his things. He reportedly also knew a woman who was hired to walk the children, the Pates children, from school. But nothing panned out with him. And then he resurfaced in 1988 in Pennsylvania, serving time on molestation. And police obviously think he's the guy. You start following a U.S. attorney, Stuart Grabois, who was so interested in talking to Jose Ramos that he had himself sworn in as a deputy prosecutor in Pennsylvania. Tell us more about following him.
He got the case in the mid-80s. It was already several years old. And he went back, as every generation of investigators have done, and started looking at everything fresh. So, I mean, Jose Ramos was one of the many, many leads that he followed to the end and back. He went to Israel because there were some rumors that Eitan had been spirited away to Israel and, you know, tromped from kibbutz to kibbutz to check on little boys named Eitan Pates. He went out to Ohio. There was a boy out there that they had some reason to believe could have been Eitan. He pursued Jose Ramos, and Ramos was in a prison in Pennsylvania, and he was serving a short molestation charge. Stuart Grabois brought him for questioning to his office in New York, at which point Ramos actually said, I took a boy that day, and I'm 90% sure that boy was Eitan Pates. I took him to my apartment. I tried to have sex with him. He protested, and I let him go, at which point he lawyered up. And Grabois then pursued him to Pennsylvania, found another case that had been outstanding of molestation, and was able to basically get the case back on the docket, prosecute him, and have him sentenced to 20 years for that other molestation case. So he's pursued him everywhere and continues to believe that Jose Ramos is, in fact, the person who took and killed Eitan.
And as we said, in 2004, a judge found Ramos liable for Eitan's death in a wrongful death civil lawsuit. So this is all going to be parsed out. But meanwhile, tell us more about the other people that investigators had to deal with over the past decades. You know, Grabois would corner people at cocktail parties if he thought they had something new, but then people would corner him too.
Yeah, I mean, there were people, there was an incredible story in the book about a medium who was sent to him by a very credible source who had had all kinds of visions, and she led Grabois and other and NYPD detectives around Manhattan and brought them to a remote location in northern Manhattan where they there was a cross with a sweater on it. There was a sort of a writing on a rock that said, you know, EP. And they ended up sending NYPD divers into the waters off the coast there. And,
by the way, I reread that chapter in your book. It's just chilling, you know, scrambling down this riverbank by the Hudson, you know, and there's this cross with the tattered remnants of a child's sweater, just teddy bears, you know, just awful, just an awful sort of hellish place. What did they think was happening there?
Well, I have to say, he is one of the most skeptical people that I know. So it's not as though he was, I mean, he dealt with mediums and psychics in the past and had always been very, very skeptical. But he thought, you know, I can't afford to just turn away. There's always a chance that she perhaps is part of this and had something to do with this kidnapping. And so they followed her down to this river's edge, and she had information she couldn't possibly have had unless she either had some kind of psychic ability or she was part of it. And so they ended up digging down there and never found anything. But ultimately, that was actually the lead that kind of tripped somebody's brain to check on some things and brought Jose Ramos's name to the forefront.
It just really is quite something. The hours logged, the time spent, the heartbreak, you know, all the people involved. It's just incredible. Anna Quinlan once wrote that Aidan Pates was the most famous missing child since the Lindbergh baby. You write about hearing a conversation between two moms in Central Park in 2004. What was that exchange?
Oh, it was actually, they were people that I know who were talking about letting, one of them was saying, I think I'm going to let, you know, my son take the public school bus to school this year. I think it would be good for him. It would give him some independence. And the other one said, I have two words for you, Eitan Pates. And that was really code. You know, everything changed when Eitan disappeared.
Yeah. Lisa Cohen, again, author of After Eitan, the Missing Child Case That Held America Captive. Lisa, do you think it's over?
I would like to think it's over. I think that would be, finally, to put this to rest after 33 years would be a wonderful thing. But I think this is all happening really fast, and there are a lot of questions to be answered. I think one of the reasons it's happening so fast is that there is, in some ways, a deadline approaching. Jose Ramos, who had been considered the prime suspect until events of this week, is due to walk free from prison in Pennsylvania on these other child molestation cases. And he's not getting parole. He is done. November 2012. And once that happens, it will be very hard to know where he is and make sure that if he is the guy, they can find him and hold on to him.
Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Quite something. And as we just said, for many Americans, the Eitan Pates case represents a moment in time. He helped launch missing children's movements, pictures on milk boxes, stranger danger. Well, next week, we're going to hear more about the cultural impact of this missing child movement, but also revisit another case, a 10-year-old named Andy Puglisi, who went missing in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1976 and hadn't been seen since, which haunted his childhood friend Melanie Perkins so much she herself investigated and made an award-winning documentary. We're going to speak with her next week. And we'll keep an eye on this story, of course. More violence across Syria as the ceasefire that's not really a ceasefire continues to be violated. This is the sound of government mortar shells hitting the city of Homs today. Syrian forces also fired tear gas and live ammunition to disperse thousands of protesters calling for President Bashar al-Assad's ouster, killing two people in the northern city of Aleppo. And today there are more questions about the role of al-Qaeda in the uprising. The Syrian government says the militant group was responsible for a car bombing in Damascus earlier this month that killed 50. Access to Syria is restricted, but the BBC's Paul Wood was able to get in, and he has this report on the influence of violent Islamists in the fighting.
A democracy protest in Syria. The Assad family are thieves, they chant. A picture of the president's head on a donkey's body. Is one of the small ironies of the Syrian uprising that the United States and al-Qaeda are on the same side here. Both want the overthrow of President Assad. Still, the US and other Western governments worry about who might replace him. The Nusra Front emerged earlier this year in customary fashion, with an internet video. The Front for the Defense of the Syrian People, to give them their full title, say they're jihadis who've returned from other wars to fight here. We bring glad tidings to the Islamic nation, says their spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Gulani. We are Syrian mujahideen. We are back from various jihad fronts to restore God's rule on earth and avenge our people's violated honor and spilled blood. We don't know if this video is genuine, but, another irony, this kind of thing serves the propaganda interests of both the global jihad movement and the Assad regime. Regardless, some outside observers believe the men of the Nusra Front do indeed represent the future in Syria.
These people are not interested in a political negotiation or a political solution.
Alistair Crook is a former MI6 officer who makes a study of Islamist militants.
It started off, and the numbers were quite small at the beginning, but they have grown in this time. The hard element of the opposition, the armed, the combat experienced people who come up from either Libya or Iraq, not only are at the vanguard, but they are actually pushing out all other forms of opposition. They are characterized by extreme use of violence.
The recent car bombings in Damascus are the result, says the regime. They blame the attacks on Islamists, maybe Al-Qaeda. The Americans fear that might be true. One reason to think it is: Syria's democratic uprising has rescued Al-Qaeda from a crisis. Peaceful revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt made them look irrelevant. Now, perhaps, they're back in the game.
Not good.
But are they? A Free Army commander called Abu Layla is testing out a sniper rifle. He would suit Syrian government propaganda. He looks jihadi. In fact, he looks like a young bin Laden. So much so, he's usually asked to leave the room when foreign journalists come.
Video or photo?
Video.
Hello, England.
He tells me he did fight in Iraq. This was a matter of defending his tribe, which is found in both countries. He met Al-Qaeda people in Iraq, he goes on, but he doesn't like Al-Qaeda. He fears them and what they would do in Syria. However, he does not believe the bombings in Damascus were done by Al-Qaeda. This lie has been used over and over again by the regime, he says. I wish they'd come up with something new. The regime lies all the time. They even lie about the weather. Are they telling the truth now that Al-Qaeda is behind these bombings? The bombings were done by the regime.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Many rebel fighters are deeply pious, but there's a moderate tradition of Islam here at odds with Al-Qaeda's harsh ideology. The suicide attacks and beheadings so familiar from Iraq have not yet come to Syria. Nevertheless, Al-Qaeda is working to gain a foothold.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
One Free Army officer told me that Al-Qaeda figures have been visiting, trying to form new alliances. They made a direct approach to a cleric near the town of Qusair. Money, weapons, and other support were offered in return for allegiance to Al-Qaeda. They turned him away. Mansourin! Mansourin! Democracy is emphatically not what Al-Qaeda is fighting for. The jihadis don't much like the Free Syrian Army either, since they are fighting under the banner of democracy too, rather than Sharia. Still, more than a year into the uprising, people are desperate for help from anywhere.
That report from the BBC's Paul Wood in Syria. This morning, astronaut Don Pettit told NASA back on Earth that he'd captured a dragon by the tail and docked it on the International Space Station, making this the first commercial delivery into space. Pettit was using the space station's 58-foot robot arm to grab the privately owned Dragon space capsule, which carried 1,000 pounds of food, clothing, computer equipment, supplies for scientific experiments. Pat Duggins is news director of Alabama Public Radio, also author of Trailblazing Mars and longtime space observer. He joins us from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Pat, put this into perspective. How big a deal is this?
Well, Robin, if writer Arthur C. Clarke was still alive, I'm sure he'd be saying, what took you so long? Because back in 1968, when he helped to produce the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, he envisioned, like, space shuttles operated by Pan Am and space stations operated by Hilton, all with an idea of big business operating and making a buck or two in low Earth orbit, while professional astronauts would fly off and do interesting things around the moon and elsewhere. And today's arrival of the SpaceX Dragon capsule is just, it's a baby step in the direction of fulfilling that vision.
Well, and this is the Dragon space capsule owned by SpaceX, which was founded by billionaire Elon Musk. Prior to this, you know, when the shuttle program was shuttered, NASA had been relying on Russia, Europe, Japan to carry goods into space. Russia ferried astronauts to the space station. Why does NASA want private companies now taking up some of this?
Well, a lot of it is national pride. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head with your earlier comment. I've got a book signing at the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian in July, and that's where Space Shuttle Discovery is. All of the shuttles have been basically gutted and stuffed, and they're going to museums. And so if we want to send astronauts into space, we have to go to the Russians hat in hand and ask them for a seat. Now, if you look closely at the design of the Dragon capsule, there are portholes on this capsule. Now, all of us in the space reporting biz sat there and thought, well, there's really not all that much reason why a cargo would have to look out a window, so something's going on. So obviously, they're talking about modifying the Dragon capsule that you saw docked today, put 7 seats in there, extra safety systems, and eventually send up human beings.
Man. Oh, and right now, Elon Musk has a $1.6 billion contract with NASA to deliver just goods to the space station. But when do you think there might be manned flights?
Well, it could be 3 to 4 years from now. I mean, sending up cargo the way he did is a relatively simple thing. I mean, this vehicle differs from, like, the Russian Progress vehicle or the Jules Verne or Kepler craft that were built by Europe, because those other ships burn up in the atmosphere. Mm. The Dragon capsule's actually designed to re-enter the atmosphere, use a heat shield, you know, blunt away all of that super heat that occurred that contributed to the Columbia accident back in 2003, and then splash down in the ocean. That will be critical if he wants to make Dragon a manned capsule, because getting up there is one thing, but getting the crew back safely, that's another.
Well, in fact, a little tip on a story coming up. We're hoping to talk to a college student here in the Boston area who, through a lottery, won a trip on a privately owned spaceship. And he has to go. He has to commit to go and train and do all sorts of work before he can do that. We're going to have that story in the coming days. But meanwhile, NASA's working with other companies to develop other types of spacecraft. What's going on?
Well, NASA's putting their eggs in a lot of different baskets, because the current flight so far of the Dragon capsule has been working just fine. But if this one works and the next one blows up, then you could successfully argue that SpaceX only has a 50% success rate. So NASA is also talking to another company about coming up with a cargo ship. And while that's going on, 4 different companies, including Boeing and Lockheed Martin, are coming up with alternative spacecraft that could carry up human beings. There's one that's a small winged spacecraft called Dream Chaser. It looks a little bit like the Storm Speeders from The Empire Strikes Back. And if one of those were to work, then we might be able to use that to send up astronauts, assuming there's a problem with the manned version of the Dragon capsule.
Yeah, well, you do remind us, you know, this can go wrong, and it could have today, and it didn't. Again, the privately owned Dragon space capsule successfully docked on the International Space Station. Pat Duggins, news director of Alabama Public Radio, author of Trailblazing Mars. Neat trick, Pat. You got in a little book signing plug there, but you know what? We want you to send us the whole list, because public radio listeners love hearing from you, and so we'll let them know where they can meet you as you are behind your new book. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Followers of Jenny Lawson's wildly popular blog, The Blogess, or her column in the Houston Chronicle, know she has a distinctive voice. She chats about her 5-foot-tall metal chicken Beyonce, her tweets with Star Trek star Will Wheaton. She posts pictures of her collection of ethically taxidermied animals, One, a tiny white mouse dressed like Hamlet, adorns the cover of her new memoir, which tells her story.
When I tell people that my father is kind of a total lunatic, they laugh and nod knowingly. They assure me that theirs is too, and that he's just a typical father. And they're right. If the typical father runs a full-time taxidermy business out of the house and shows up at the local bar with a miniature donkey and a Teddy Roosevelt impersonator and thinks other people are weird for making such a big deal out of it. If the typical father says things like, "Happy birthday, here's a bathtub of raccoons," or "We'll have to take your car, mine has too much blood in it," then yeah, he's totally normal. Still, I don't remember any of the kids from Charles in Charge feeling around the deep freeze for the popsicles and instead pulling out an enormous frozen rattlesnake that Charles had thrown in while it was still alive. Maybe I missed that episode. We didn't watch a lot of TV.
Blogger Jenny Lawson reading from her new book, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, a mostly true memoir. You can hear why she gets 2 to 3 million hits a month at her blog. But Jenny Lawson also taps into something else. She can bring you to tears, talking about her depression or her miscarriages, the kind where she had to carry a dead fetus for a month and have a nervous breakdown. All this before having a beautiful little girl with her husband, Victor. We want to spend a few minutes today with blogger Jenny Lawson. She joins us from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I have to ask, how are you doing? Because one of the things you talk about is you are a very shy person, curling up in a ball at times with such anxiety, and it's diagnosed anxiety disorder, that you can't, you know, that you blurt out completely inappropriate things at dinner parties or can't
exactly
function at all, you know, so this must be hard.
This is really difficult. I am very lucky in that, first of all, I've had a lot of behavioral therapy, which kicks in. Secondly, I have a lot of drugs, which also kick in. When I first started touring and I would have to do interviews and do readings, my therapist said, well, you know, we can put you on this special drug while you're on tour. And a lot of like rock stars use it when they go out on stage. It's a performance drug. And I was like, you're going to give me cocaine? And she was like, no, it's an anxiety drug. What is wrong with you? Why would you even go there? And I'm like, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly why I need the drugs.
Because you blurt things out. Well, you know, one of the chapters in your book is the first time you sort of got together with kind of a girl's slumber party with other female bloggers. And you say, well, this is actually what a lot of us have in common.
Absolutely. I was terrified the entire time and felt really uncomfortable and just kept basically proving to myself that I don't get along well with women. And it was about halfway through that I realized that every woman that was there was having the exact same conversation in their head. And I realized that I was bringing all of this emotional baggage that I had been carrying since grade school, when you first start to feel like, I don't fit in, I'm all alone, no one's going to ever get me.
And yet you met these other women who maybe had some of the same feelings. And is that why blogging worked for you and them?
I think so. You know, when I first started writing about the fact that I have depression and anxiety disorder, it was difficult to be that kind of honest about it, but I really felt like I didn't have another choice. For me, I've always felt like it's very obvious to everyone around me that I am anxious and nervous and just about to hide under the table, which I probably will do at some point during this interview. And what was interesting is when I first started writing about it, how many people came out of the woodwork to not only support me and say, you know, me too, you're not alone, but also how many people came out and said, my sister has anxiety disorder or my father has it, and I never understood it until I heard you explain it in that way, and now maybe I understand it a little better. What's really been a surprise, though, is that in the past, I would say year or so, I've become very open about it, and whenever I'm having a depression period or if I'm going through a period where I just cannot write, I'm very honest about it on the blog, and people are very supportive. And I've gotten a ton of emails from people saying that they read not just the post, but they read the comments on the post and the comments on the post of thousands of people saying, me too, you're not alone, told them that they weren't alone and made them decide not to kill themselves. And I've gotten so many emails like that of people who were saved because of the support of strangers.
Well, and this becomes even more worth noting because, you know, before we know this about you in reading the book, if you haven't, you know, read the blogs, it's just so funny, this life you talk about. You know, oh, yeah, when I was playing hide-and-seek with my sister once, I kind of tripped and fell into the carcass of a dead deer. Or, yeah, we had neighbors who used to invite us over to swim in their pool, which was actually an open-air cistern that was used to clean pigs. You know, it's just funny stuff. I'm wondering, did you start using that stuff to mask, you know, how you were really feeling? Or did you see the humor in that stuff maybe because of how you were feeling? I don't know.
For me, humor is therapy. And so if I come up against something, whether it be infertility or anxiety disorder or depression, if I can find a way to laugh at it, there's something about laughing at something that's this enormous demon that makes it so much less of a monster. And for me, that's sort of been my whole role, is chronicling my life in a way that I can find the laughter in everything, even in things that you wouldn't necessarily find laughter in.
Yeah. Let's talk about the miscarriages, because I'm thinking when you tell us in your chapter in the new book about the miscarriages, it comes as such a shock, you know, and you say it's going to be really, really sad for a little while, but then it ends up okay.
Yes.
It was really, really, really sad.
It was, and I think that was why it was important for me to write about it, because for me, things aren't really over unless I have the ability to put it in a chapter and shut the door on it. So writing about losing children was extremely difficult. Writing about having an anxiety attack actually put me into anxiety attacks. When I wrote the anxiety chapter, for example, I had about 4 anxiety attacks just writing that one page explaining what it feels like. And it's interesting, my grandmother always used to, whenever she would talk about cancer, she would whisper it. She would be like, and then so-and-so has cancer, because mm-hmm. she felt like if you said it out loud, it was like you were calling it down on you. And I see where that comes from, because so often when I write about depression or anxiety, it does feel like I'm kind of bringing it onto me. But at the same time, it feels like every single time I get a little bit stronger and the pieces that are broken heal in a stronger way that aren't going to break again.
The bloggess Jenny Lawson, her book is Let's Pretend This Never Happened, tells the story of her often bizarre upbringing in rural Texas, very funny, but also of her health struggles, depression, miscarriages, after which she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, became suicidal, tough. Then she and husband Victor had little Haley. She writes about that birth in great detail as well. But Jenny, the tough stuff, you know, not just the depression, the anxiety, the issue that you had during pregnancy that meant you had to give yourself shots all the time, but also you had some form of arthritis. It sounds horrible.
It's no fun. It's polyrheumatoid arthritis, which means that it's in a different joint every day, which basically means I go to sleep not knowing what part of me is going to wake up stabbed by Freddy Krueger. Although I have to say, very luckily, I think we've found the perfect combination of drugs. So I actually have not been in a wheelchair in the last 6 months. So, woohoo!
Well, and those are very serious, and they sound very, you know, very painful. But do you ever find yourself wondering, especially as you look at the aggregate here in the memoir, why do these things happen to me? Why do they happen to me?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm the new Job. Who knew?
Not just the illnesses, but of course, your father's live turkeys follow you to school one day and completely humiliate you. Or you're the one girl in the farming class who, with your arm up the cow to mm-hmm. inseminate it, loses the syringe.
It always happens to me. You know, what's interesting is, well, two things. One is, I think these things happen to everyone. It's just that we block them out.
But you have more than most.
I think I probably do. But I think at the same time, you know, you're not given more than you can handle. And when it comes right down to it, all of the things that are in this book, and, you know, the reason why I called it Let's Pretend This Never Happened is because I wanted to pretend that this stuff had never happened, because they were all the most, you know, mortifying moments of my life. But then when it came right down to it, those were the moments that I remembered in my life, and those were the moments that made me who I am today.
And in fact, you and Victor move little Haley back to rural Texas. Why? What was the pull? What did you want for Haley?
Well, you know, when Haley was first born, I wanted her to have everything that I never had. So I was like, she's going to have ballet lessons and piano. And she's going to be the most normal kid ever. And I realized about a year or two into that I really didn't want that for her, both because normal's pretty boring and also because she's not going to fit into our family if she's normal. So I started thinking about my childhood and all the things in my childhood, and I thought, she's not getting any of these bizarre moments that I had growing up, and she's not going to get them unless we go back to the country. And so that's what we decided to do, and we found all of our own brand new weird moments that put the strange and the wondrous together.
Just give us a couple.
Let's see. One of my favorites is there's a guy that lives down the street from us, and he gives away hairless rats and flying squirrels. And so you see these notes that he's plastered everywhere where he's written, handwritten, you know, free flying squirrels. And then a week later, you'll see another note that'll just say free squirrels. And the flying is all scratched out. And you're like, how many squirrels died before he realized these squirrels can't fly?
But I love on the note, because you put photograph, because you know people won't believe these things, you have photographs of everything.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I love
oh,
it.
Yeah.
You know, for the kids.
For the kid, yeah, free for kids. Delivery 24 hours. I'm like, who needs 24 hours delivery for flying squirrels? What kind of an emergency is that?
Well, speaking of squirrels flying and otherwise, what is your fascination with taxidermied little things, like the mouse with the red cape a la Hamlet with the skull on his little tiny hand? He's striking a pose. It's a real mouse that somebody has taxidermied that way. Is it just some edible, you know, some because your father was a taxidermist? What is your attraction?
I think part of it is that, you know, my father was a taxidermist, still is a taxidermist. And so I think there's a little part of me that is, you know, a little bit of a daddy's girl. But, you know, growing up, I never liked any of the taxidermy. And it wasn't until I found this, you know, little mouse who was wearing a cape and this little Hamlet von Schnitzel. And then I realized that was my calling, is to find ethically taxidermied, so they had to have died of natural causes, taxidermied animals wearing clothing.
Well, fortunately, that's not the only thing you do with clothing. The red dress, what is it?
Years ago, I had written this post about how I had always wanted a red silk ball gown, but I knew that I would never go any place that I would ever wear it. And it was just one of those things that, you know, you always think in the back of your mind of that one thing that you really want, but you know you're never going to get. And then I thought, you know what? Why not? So I found a friend who made this giant red ball gown for me. And I found another friend who agreed to come with me out to a cemetery. And I changed into this ball gown because I couldn't even fit it into my car. So I'm like naked in a cemetery putting on this red ball gown. And she took these amazing pictures of me. And I shared it in a post and talked about how everyone should go out and find their red dress, whether it's taking flying lessons or, you know, walking on the trapeze or whatever that one weird thing is that you think, oh, I don't really need this, but you're worth it. So I wrote about it and I had someone reply and say, I'm going to a blogging conference that you're going to. I haven't left the house in a long time. I'm really agoraphobic. And going to this blogging conference will be the finish line of this therapy that I've gone to. And so I said, well, you know what? I'll bring the red dress and you can wear it when you get there. So I brought the red dress and met her, and she was lovely. And I took these pictures of her and she was crying wearing the red dress, and I posted them. And then someone else said, you know, I'd like to wear the red dress because I'm, you know, going through this sex change, and, you know, that's my red dress. And so we did those pictures. But what happened is it started to get a little bit ratty and torn. And so I wrote a post about how I was going to buy some new red dresses. And suddenly all of these women came from, and not just women, men and women, came from out of the woodwork to say, I want to buy a red dress for someone. And so we set up this Facebook page, just I think it's just called the Traveling Red Dress, where if you had a red dress that you wanted to give away, you could just put a picture up there, and the first person to say, I'd like it, got it, and they pass it on to the next person. And so there are literally thousands of traveling red dresses that are just being flung all over the world.
It's just it's a tribute to you, but it's so amazing what can happen on blogs. I mean, are you finding yourself constantly thinking, wow?
I am. I am constantly amazed at the support and also at how many people have come out to say, oh my God, I'm not alone. So many of us are finding our tribe and finding that we're not the only weirdos out there.
That's Jenny Lawson. Her new memoir is Let's Pretend This Never Happened. We'll also link you up to blogs and her Twitter accounts at hereandnow.org. And Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.